Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this episode, an attorney general is the chief lawyer for a state's legislatures, agencies, and citizens. That's a lot of lawyering for any AG, but it's been an especially busy year for Washington State Attorney General Bob Ferguson, one in which he made the decision to take the President of the United States to court. Ferguson was elected Attorney General in 2012 after a career path that included service on the King County Council, litigation for a major Seattle law firm, clerkships for federal judges, and a stint as a traveling chess master. In this talk, he shares the story of his fascination with chess and the behind-the-scenes drama of his challenge to President Trump's so-called Muslim ban. The intent of Executive Order 13769, titled Protecting the Nation from Foreign Terrorist Entry into the United States, was to ban certain categories of people from seven countries from entering the U.S. It was blocked in federal court due to the efforts of Ferguson and his staff. Attorney General Bob Ferguson received his undergraduate degree from the University of Washington. He says he didn't have the grades to make it into UW's law school because he was spending too much time, yes, playing chess. Ferguson spoke to a gathering of UW law students at William H. Gates Hall on March 11th. Here, UW School of Law Dean Kelly Testy introduces his talk.
It's such a delight for me as the Dean of the University of Washington School of Law to welcome you all today to hear from Attorney General Bob Ferguson. We are just honored and delighted to host you today and welcome you to the law school. I often remark as the Dean of the law school that sometimes we take law for granted. It's a little bit like the air we breathe, and sometimes until it's missing, we don't quite notice. And then we're, of course, gasping for the protections and the life that it supplies. And so I want to today say that we have been so delighted to see the leadership from Attorney General Ferguson in Washington State as our nation has grappled with some very difficult political times, including what's come to be known as President Trump's Muslim travel ban, where Washington State stood up and was a leader in saying that that was not in conformance with the rule of law. So I want to welcome Attorney General Ferguson today here and let you know that he has a wonderfully distinguished background in law. Many of you may know him more in his current job, but he began his legal career in Spokane. He clerked for two federal judges before joining Preston Gates and Ellis, which is now known as the K&L Gates firm. And he also was elected to the King County Council in 2003, where he served for 9 years before being elected as our Attorney General in 2012. He is our 18th Attorney General. And as the state's chief legal officer, he's done a splendid job in protecting the people of Washington against powerful interests that don't play by the rules, including our president. It's my distinct honor to welcome Attorney General Bob Ferguson.
Thank you so much, Dean, and thanks for all your many years of service at the University of Washington Law School and Seattle University Law School. So we're going to miss you in your current role, of course. We look forward to what's next. We had a delightful lunch before coming down here, so it's always great to see the dean. Always great to be back at the University of Washington. I always look for a good excuse to put on my purple tie, which I did this morning. I'm a Husky. My mom and dad were Huskies. I got siblings who are Huskies. My wife's a Husky. God willing, my 9-year-old twins, they'll be Huskies as well. So we're pretty serious about all things Husky. So I was also relieved to see that Coach Peterson, our football coach, signed the renewal in his contract. I was worried I'd have to get personally involved in those negotiations to ensure he stays at the UW. I'm glad it all got worked out. Well, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. And it's great to be here. And I have a presentation. Slide presentation about the travel ban litigation, of course. I think what I thought I'd preview it by saying that it's, well, obviously I'm going to be talking about the law. I'll talk about our legal claims, right? I'll work through that. I'll talk about the district court proceeding, the court of appeals proceeding we had. I'll have a lot of focus will be on what I hope to be of interest to you, which is essentially what was going on behind the scenes in the office, conversations we were having, our decision-making process on the lawsuit itself, what that was like for the attorneys and professional staff in our office, I'm a little bit limited what I can say about certain conversations I had, as you can imagine, but my goal is to try and provide some insight that maybe you wouldn't get from picking up a newspaper and reading about in the New York Times or the Washington Post or the Seattle Times or somewhere else. That's my objective. And before I start, one thing I want to emphasize is that I have pictures of some of the attorneys who from my team who worked on this case, and a couple of them are University of Washington graduates, Colleen Melody and Kelly Paradis. Colleen graduated in 2009, first in her class, I believe, from University of Washington Law School in 2009. She's the head of my civil rights unit at the AG's office. And Kelly is a graduate of the UW Law School in 2013. These are attorneys I was talking to every single day throughout this process. And what I want to emphasize is the team working on this case, they're young attorneys. They're not much, most of them have less than 10 years experience as an attorney. My Solicitor General, Noah Purcell, who you'll be hearing about, who's quite a brilliant guy, he just went back to Harvard for his 10-year anniversary as a lawyer, okay? So I want to emphasize with you as law students that, look, I know for me, when I went to law school, grappling with civil procedure or con law, it could seem abstract to me, right? I could sometimes question the relevance of what this particular chapter and this particular Civ Pro book would mean to me in my life, but I just want to tell you, it's all those things have come back in a case like this. And so I encourage you to think about that, right? That the things you're learning now, they will have direct applicability to your life as attorney, and it may happen sooner than you otherwise might think. So let's get started, and I've got some slides, and what I'll do is at the end, I have plenty of time for questions, and happy to take them afterwards. So I'm gonna start with a video that hopefully the volume's up and you can hear it. So it's a video of Donald Trump campaigning for president of the United States, and you'll hear him talk about wanting to create a Muslim ban. And what you hear, this quote was literally part of our complaint that we filed in the federal district court. So let's see if this goes right to him.
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States until our country's representatives can figure out what the hell is going on.
So that was during the campaign. And when the campaign was over and he was elected, Rudy Giuliani went on national TV, and he said the following. He said, I'll tell you the whole history of it, referring to the Muslim ban concept. I'll tell you the whole history of it. So when Donald Trump first announced it, he said, Muslim ban. He called me up. He said, put a commission together. Show me the right way to do it legally. That was also quoted in our complaint, which I'll talk about a bit later on. So it was clear, I think, from Donald Trump and his key advisors that he wanted to create a Muslim ban. They were quite open about it. And so he signed the executive order, 13769, and he signed it, as you might recall, on a Friday evening is when he signed it. And as it turned out, I happened to be at a conference in Florida with a group of Democratic attorneys general in Florida. And I was flying back Saturday morning to Seattle. And so I landed, I think, at SeaTac at noon. The executive order, as you can imagine, when I landed at the airport, my phone had blown up with messages. Now, we knew the executive order was likely coming, and the team knew that once an executive order was signed, they were to obviously immediately review it, right? We talked about that this might be happening. I think one reason we were able to move so quickly was we were not, frankly, caught by surprise. When he said he was going to create a Muslim ban, I took him at his word. That said, we were, I think I can speak for everybody who was intimately involved in this, we were taken aback by the breadth of the executive order, how broad it was, and the fact that it went into effect immediately, which created all kinds of chaos, as you know. Literally, people on airplanes, the executive order was signed, went into effect immediately, and they were turned away at airports once they landed. I think you probably know the basics of the executive order. I'll just quickly move through some of the key elements that were relevant to our lawsuit. So, of course, it suspended all travel from seven Muslim-majority countries. Right, that was number one for 90 days. Number two, suspended the entire U.S. refugee admission program for 120 days. It prioritized admissions of individuals on the basis of religious-based persecution, provided that the religion of the individual is a minority religion in their country, which had the effect essentially of granting a priority for Christians, for example. Next, we had suspended the entry of Syrian refugees indefinitely. There are many other aspects to the executive order, but these were some of the key core provisions that we were examining very closely. A lot of folks have asked, hey, why was Washington State first in getting this filed? And we were the first state or the first lawsuit that challenged the very constitutionality of the executive order, as you probably know. And so what happened was I get home Saturday at noon and the phone is kind of blown up and I'm talking to folks in my office and I find out very quickly that there's going to be a press conference at the airport. As you might recall, that weekend there were protests at airports, spontaneous protests at airports all around the country, including SeaTac. So there's going to be a press conference like at 3 o'clock that afternoon. It's maybe 1 o'clock now, and I've landed. And I was invited to stay at the press conference with the governor and to speak. And I wanted to do that, of course, but the legal team was already at work. And I had messages from them saying, hey, this executive order, as I mentioned earlier, is even more broad than we frankly had imagined it could be. And so those attorneys were leaving their ski trips, for example, and they're all heading down to the office. And so I decided to skip the press conference and go home, say hello to my wife and my kids, hadn't seen them for a while, and then essentially get to work. And so I think three reasons why I think we were first. One, we anticipated that executive order. I referenced that before. We were not caught by surprise. We were having conversations, calling Melody, Noah Purcell, myself, about a potential travel ban. So the team knew when it came out to review it and go to work, and I was interested in it. Number two, we had resources to do it. It's a big piece of litigation, as this group can probably appreciate, right? And I created a civil rights unit in my office in 2013, 2014. Up until then, if you called the AG's office, and keep in mind, we have nearly 600 attorneys, by the way, in our office and 13 offices all around the state. But if you called our office in the last 50 years with a civil rights complaint, we referred you somewhere else. What's up with that, right? I mean, quite literally, if you called our office and said, hey, I've got a civil rights complaint, we do consumer protection, we do antitrust, we do criminal law, we do every kind of law you can imagine, right? We do it all. But if you called our office with a civil rights complaint, we referred you somewhere else. So I created a civil rights unit, of which Colleen Melody, who I mentioned before, she's the head of it, right? And you'll meet some other attorneys from that unit. So I did not anticipate when creating that unit that someday they'd be filing a lawsuit against the president, right? But we had a team in place, very strong attorneys who were ready and had, and we had the resources and the ability to take on the litigation. Third, looking at the time, so it's a Saturday when I was talking to Noah, and I just tell you how the conversation went. So Noah's got the office right next to mine. He's my solicitor general, top lawyer in the office, and grew up here in Seattle, went to Franklin High School, University of Washington for undergrad, then Harvard for law school. He was editor of the Law Review at Harvard, clerked on the D.C. Circuit, and then he clerked for Justice Souter on the U.S. Supreme Court, came back and was minding his own business, working, making a lot of money at a private law firm in Seattle. I think he was 32 when I asked him to be my Solicitor General. Now, the only problem was he'd never argued a case for the U.S. Supreme Court or even the State Supreme Court, which is kind of the job description for Solicitor General, right? And Noah, you'll see a picture of him. He's 32, and he looks like he's 22. I got to be honest, right? He's very, very youthful looking, and he was the youngest Solicitor General in the country when I hired him. So like I know a lot of folks raised their eyebrows in the office. It was one of my first decisions as a new attorney general, but I knew Noah was a very brilliant attorney. I've met a lot of fantastic attorneys in my time as a lawyer. I think Noah's perhaps the most brilliant lawyer I've ever met, period. So I really felt he could bring something to our office that would be unique. And so over the years in working with Noah, I trust his judgment, implicitly, trust his judgment. He's a very, very smart guy, and he has a very keen grasp of the Constitution and what courts are likely to think about constitutional arguments. So, you know, if you were listening to the conversation with Noah, it was like 50 other conversations I've had with him, to be perfectly honest. Like, yes, we knew it was an important decision. I don't want to understate it, right? We knew it was important for obvious reasons, but it was not a particularly hard decision. And I realize that may sound counterintuitive, right? But here's why I say that. When I talk to Noah, if I'm making a decision like this, I ask him the same question almost always. Number one, are Washingtonians being harmed, right? First question. People I represent are they being harmed? Here, that was pretty easy, right? We had students from the University of Washington who were abroad and couldn't come back into the United States, right? There was all sorts of harms to Washingtonians. Couldn't travel, see their loved ones. You get the idea. We knew there was harm. Next question is, do we have good constitutional arguments? Bring a case. And so we spent some time, obviously, talking about that. You'll see some of them shortly. And, Noah felt we did. He felt we did. And then third, of course, was whether we had standing, whether I as Attorney General could bring the lawsuit, or as this group would know, hey, does it have to be an individual who's being denied entry to the state, for example? And we felt we had good arguments on standing. So from my standpoint, it's the question kind of answers itself, doesn't it? Washingtonians are being harmed. We have good arguments. We think we have standing. I'm the Attorney General. Right? Question answer itself. Yeah, we're gonna, you know, we're gonna file a lawsuit. And I think, for what it's worth, I think where lawyers or executives get into trouble in making a decision, this is my experience, I see it all the time, where they get into trouble is in making a decision, they ask questions that are not relevant to the decision. It's tempting as hell, don't get me wrong, right? What are the politics of this decision? Believe me, I am aware when making a decision that there could be implications for me, right, away from the office. I'm not dumb, I get that, right? I get the idea that we may file a lawsuit and that may anger the Trump administration. There could be repercussions for our state in some other way. Aware of that, right? They're all, those questions are interesting. Don't get me, I'm happy to chat about them if you want, right? But they're interesting, but are they relevant to the decision to file a lawsuit as the attorney for the people of the state? I don't think so. And so I think that was another reason why we moved was, I think we just stayed focused. We kept our eye on the ball, I think is what I'm trying to say. And of course, lastly, look, a decision has to get made. And there's a risk associated with that. I mean, I knew if we filed the lawsuit, and keep in mind back then, the travel ban was popular in the polls. Legal experts, you watched Anderson Cooper and the row of legal experts, thought the legal arguments were weak. No standing, weak constitutional arguments. That was a pervasive opinion that was out there. And so I knew if we filed it, and look, we went before Judge Robart and he said, hey, Ferguson, you have no standing here. That was going to be a bad day at the office, right? That was going to be a bad day at the office. But I felt it was a risk that we needed to take. And just to elaborate that a little bit, as I think the dean knows, a long, long time ago, after I graduated high school, I decided not to go to college right away. And I was going to try and become a professional chess player, which is not the usual route to becoming Attorney General, but it worked for me, right? So I played chess all the time. I obsessed over chess. That's what I did, right? The reason I did not get accepted to the University of Washington Law School is because my grades as an undergraduate here were not especially good because I was playing chess all the time. You're already one step ahead of me. You got in here. I did not, right? So I went to Europe and I was playing chess internationally. And one thing about chess, it really informs the way I think about the world and think about my work. I just take my word for it. My team knows that. I'm always telling chess stories. So in playing chess, I discovered there's kind of two kinds of chess players. Let's say you're looking at a game, and of course what you have to do is analyze potential moves and see a position in the future, right? And you have to evaluate whether that position in the future is, I'm oversimplifying, is good for you or bad for you, right? So I'm saying to myself, I play knight e4, he plays bishop c5, I play rook c6, he plays queen e8. How's that position look? Good, bad, what is it, right? And based on that evaluation, you get better at it as you become a better chess player, you make a decision which move to make. The only problem is that no matter how good you get at chess, and if the world champion, Magnus Carlsen, was standing here, he'd tell you the same thing. No matter how good you get at chess, there are some positions you are visualizing in the future that are just so complicated, you don't know. You don't know. It could be a winning position for you. It could be a losing position for you. But it's so complicated, only machine can crunch it and understand, okay? So again, I discovered there's two kinds of chess players. Chess players who are willing to go in those kinds of positions and chess players who are not. And even to the point where I would be playing a game and afterwards I'd say to an opponent, why did you not play knight e4? And he'd say, well, I looked at those moves and the position was so complicated, I didn't like it, it was too complicated. I'd say, well, yeah, but with the move you played, you knew your position was worse. You knew it was worse, so why didn't you take the chance? Didn't like it, too complicated, I wasn't comfortable going in that position. Now, I had my weaknesses as a chess player, believe me, but that was never a problem for me. If I felt my best chance to win the game was to go into a very complicated position where I could win or I could lose, well, I did it, right? I did it. Now, I wasn't a cowboy about it, right? I mean, I want to win the game, but you based on your training and your thinking and all the experience you have to take that calculated risk, take a calculated risk. Well, in a way, that's what happened in this decision. If I don't file the lawsuit, I know my position's bad, right? More importantly, I know the position of the people in my state is bad. The travel ban is in effect, and it's going to go on. That's not good. Or I can take a calculated risk. We think we have good arguments. I've got a good legal team. You've got a great legal team. I'm taking the chance, right? So I encourage you to think about that, right? With the law or whatever you do with your life, right, is it's important. It's important to take calculated risks. Your whole life is full. I mean, who you get married to, right? What job you take, what school you go to. It's all calculated risk at the end of the day. But I find on big decisions sometimes, and I see this with electeds all the bloody time, don't want to take a calculated risk, too cautious. And sometimes you got to take a chance. So I think those combinations were why we went forward. So here's some of the legal team. So that weekend was Super Bowl Sunday. So we made the decision to file. One thing that's in fairness to the team that I should mention, I asked them to file Monday. Okay? The executive order signed Friday night. We're all in the office Saturday. We're trying to file Monday. It's a complicated, complicated filing. Just take my word for it, right? And we want to file Monday. If we filed Monday, we might be able to get before a federal judge that Friday. And we're seeking an injunction, a temporary restraining order. And we knew every hour mattered. Every hour mattered. So the goal was, you know, we got to crank this thing out, right? So this is Sunday, Super Bowl Sunday. The whole team was there at 6 in the morning, on Sunday morning, working. Wherever you go in your life with work, work hard. Work hard. Your boss notices this. Take my word for it, right? And no one had to tell them to be there at 6 in the morning. They were just there. And after working late, late Saturday night, they were all there Sunday morning, 6 a.m. So to my, let's see, you're looking at this too. Next to me is Colleen Melody, who I mentioned before, UW law grad. Next to her is Marcia Chen, also in the Civil Rights Unit. I think Marcia's a graduate of University of Pennsylvania Law School. And next to Marcia is Patricio Marquez, a Stanford law graduate. I think he's been out of law school, he's like the veteran. He's been out 13 years, I think. That's Patricio. Those are a few of the folks. One person who's not here is Kelly, who I mentioned before, who I think is 2013, UW. So this was the weekend. This was the weekend scene, and folks were working very hard to file it on Monday. I think I already mentioned we were the first lawsuit that challenged the very constitutionality of the litigation. I do want to just take a minute to mention we had support for that filing on Monday from declarations from the University of Washington. We had to show we had standing. We had to show harm to Washingtonians and state agencies, right? Lost tuition dollars, for example. Another example who we reached out to was Noah had the idea. He said, Bob, it'd be great if big companies in Washington State filed declarations Monday saying how much it's harming their businesses and their employees. So literally Sunday morning early, I called a corporate counsel for Amazon and Expedia. These are folks I just know through my work, and I said, hey, we're doing this. Would you be willing to file a declaration? And I remember one of them said, well, yeah, when are you filing? And I said, well, tomorrow. And he said, to his great grace, said, okay, right? I thought he was going to say, well, how the heck are you going to do that? He said, okay. And so Amazon, Expedia, for example, filed declarations. Later in the litigation, 97 tech companies joined them. We had national security experts who filed declarations. But a lot was going on that weekend. It wasn't just filing the complaint. We had to pull together our declarations for that standing argument that we knew was coming our way. So our case had multiple constitutional and statutory arguments. I shouldn't say thrown together over the weekend, but put together carefully crafted over the weekend. Carefully crafted over the weekend. And Noah and I have talked about how our thing of the case, as you might imagine, has evolved over time since that first frantic weekend. I'm just going to quickly move through these. I'm not an expert in each and every one of these. I focus a bit more on the constitutional ones. There's a lot of them. I just want to give you a sense of what was put in the complaint. And I think this is a non-exclusive list, by the way. So we had our constitutional arguments. The one that got a lot of attention was our First Amendment Establishment Clause argument for the Muslim ban, part of our legal argument. We also had equal protection and due process claims as well. We had a bucket of constitutional claims that we brought before the court on Monday. We also had, and these did not get as much attention, a large number of statutory claims. I think the Administration Procedures Act. Administrative Procedures Act is at the bottom there, for example. I mentioned that because when President Obama signed his executive order on immigration reform, it was struck down. A Republican AG challenged him in Texas in federal court, and a judge in Texas struck it down, and that was based on the APA. So I know to the public, and even to me, right, these statutes can seem a little bit obscure, right? But in litigation like this, they have great meaning. So we had a group of statutory violations as well that we alleged, just to give you a sense of our claims. So that's me actually signing the complaint, which, nice, calm, sign it. But of course, as soon as I signed it, here's what happened. This is from a Reuters, a national publication, wrote about us trying to get it filed by Monday. Remember I told you the plan was to file it Monday? So they wrote, unlike other court papers filed electronically, a paper copy of that motion had to be delivered to the clerk's office in person. So Noah Purcell, Solicitor General, led a race to the Seattle courthouse with others in the office. But just as the building was about to close, they pulled up to the courthouse, jumped out of the car, and ran up the steps to the doors before they were locked. They arrived just in time. And it really, I wasn't there, but apparently happened just like that, you know, like a scene out of a movie. It really was like that. So that they pulled it off. I mean, right, that was an extraordinary amount of work in a very, very, very compressed amount of time. And the briefing was excellent. That's Noah, by the way. So to give you an idea of that week, so we file it Monday. The next day, Judge Robart, we're assigned Judge Robart, a judge appointed by George W. Bush. He's who gets assigned to us. Tuesday, I think it was the next day, he sets the schedule and he gives us the hearing on Friday. Great. Only bad news is, I forget exactly the briefing schedule, but the Department of Justice is going to file a response midnight on Thursday, I think it was. And then we had to get our reply in at 10 a.m. or noon Friday morning, and the hearing was like at 3 in the afternoon. This is something, you get the idea, something like that. So that week, this is not an exaggeration at all. When I say that the legal team was working around the clock, that is true. They had shifts. A certain number of folks would work until midnight, and then another team would come in and pick it up from there. It was literally an around-the-clock, it was an around-the-clock operation. You know, we were getting more declarations. So one story to maybe illustrate how intense that week was. So after the hearing with Judge Robart on Tuesday, when the schedule was set, I sat down with Noah to talk about an important decision, who's going to actually do the oral argument, right? I mean, it's only going to be the biggest oral argument of somebody's life, right? And it's going to be in 3 days. We need to decide who's going to do it. It's either myself or Noah or Colleen, right? So it's one of the three of us. So I sit down with Noah and I said, Noah, what do you think about who should do the oral argument? I'll never forget. He looked at me and said, Bob, that's Thursday's problem. The decision of who's going to argue it, everybody was so busy, that's Thursday. We can't even think about it now. And that's what I said, okay. So on Thursday, we sat down. I knew I wasn't going to argue at that point. That's Thursday's problem. I'm no dummy, Dean. I suppose that you were calling at that point, right? So, I mean, it, you know, say it was complex. You saw the claims, right? I mean, it's obviously a big, big case. So he had one moot court on Friday, the day of the argument, before he walked into Judge Robart's courtroom. So Noah did it. That's in my office also sometime during that week. So there's Judge Robart, who I mentioned, nominated by President George W. Bush, unanimously confirmed by the Senate. Good judge, fair judge, tough judge, asks a lot of questions. I think the oral argument that Noah had is online. You can watch it. If you haven't seen it, I encourage you to check it out. If you want to get an idea of a hot bench and a judge who walks in prepared with pointed questions. And look, he's not feeling sorry for you that you've only had 24 hours to prepare for, right? He's expecting answers. He's going to make a big decision, as he should, right? As he should. I do remember thinking at the end of the oral argument before he made his decision, I do remember thinking, look, whichever way he ruled, I felt we got a fair shake. He clearly knew the case. He knew the issues. His clerks no doubt helped as well on that. I mean, he was on it. And so he issued his decision from the bench. Again, we're seeking an injunction from the court to put a stop to the executive order immediately. And so there's Noah doing his oral argument before Judge Robart. And then we won. Judge Robart granted our injunction. And, you know, it was great. I mean, I don't really have words to express what it felt like, but it was a great moment. That's the courthouse steps afterwards. The guy behind me with the sign, I'm with Bob, is not a state employee, I want to be clear. He's not a state employee. Just happened to be there, I guess. I don't know. But he knew where to put himself for the pictures, I guess. So that's Colleen next to me and Noah on the team. You know, it was interesting in that right after we had the press conference, things were completely crazy at this point, as you can imagine, national media and stuff. And so I always look for an excuse to put a picture of my mom in my slides. And so I think I've got it right here. So now you might be wondering why there's a picture of me as a 9-year-old boy with my mom. That's the two of us. But I have a story about my mom about this. So right after this, my phone rings, and it's my mom. So she's 88 now. She's a retired public school teacher. She turns 89 in a month and a half or so, sharp as a tack. And so she's calling. So I pick it up, of course. It's my mom. And she says, Bobby, she said, I just got the strangest phone call. I said, well, what is it? She said, well, someone with Anderson Cooper called. They're with CNN, and they want to talk to you. What's going on? So, I don't know whether they thought I live with my mom still or what exactly. But they couldn't track me down. The phones were blowing up, so they got resourceful, and they found my mom and called her up. So that's why my mom's here. So I knew life had changed a little bit at that point. The impacts, of course, were immediate. And just for what it's worth, I mean, this was interesting to me. I actually went on Anderson Cooper that night. It was a half-hour interview. He had Alan Dershowitz, David Gergen, whole panel of folks. And it was a pretty intense interview. And, you know, one of the challenges was we just come off this big, big win, and suddenly I have to give a reasoned, sober, you know, review of what had happened, right? With very little time to prepare. What struck me about the conversation with them was they had a hard time grasping that that travel ban had been stopped, effective immediately. It was over. It had been stopped until the judge could rule on the merits. That they just did not see it coming. I'm just telling you, they did not see it coming. And so that was impact number one, immediate effect. Of course, tens of thousands of visas that had been revoked, as you might recall, folks who had travel visas, those were reinstated. I think there were about 500,000 folks who had green cards, for example, who could not travel under the original executive order, who now could travel, for example. So the impacts were immediate. I'll just give you an example or two. So Mr. Robbie is a Somali native, was approved for a green card, and he was intended to reunite with his wife, who's an American citizen here in Seattle, the day after the executive order was issued. So he was on a plane, flew at SeaTac Airport, and I believe he was the first person turned away at SeaTac Airport as a result. So the first time I had a chance to meet someone who was able to come back in the country after the travel ban was stopped was Mr. Robbie. The governor and I went down to meet him. There he is at SeaTac Airport, which was great. You know, we just had been so busy up to that day. This was maybe a week or so after the travel ban had been stopped. I'm kind of losing track of time, but we were so busy. I hadn't even seen on TV scenes, which were just airing all the time, of reunions at airports. You know, that was going on, right? We just didn't have time, so it was great to go down there. Another individual, when I was there seeing Mr. Robbie, there was just a guy there at the carousel who someone said had just come in from Iran. He'd been trying to travel to the U.S. with his daughter to be reunited with his wife, Mr. Novak, and his wife's a Silverdale nurse, and he'd been turned away as well. So he just had landed in from Iraq. That's him and his wife, and that's them at SeaTac Airport. So, you know, it's a case, you know, part of the reason why you know, there's been such a response to it. I'm still trying to, I think we're all, my team's trying to process it still. It's been a little overwhelming in many respects, but people, it's, you know, the law impacts people in such a deeply personal way, right? For good or for bad, law does impact people in deeply personal ways, and there's no better example of that than this travel ban, right? People's lives were uprooted, right? There was chaos. I mean, 4-month-old babies trying to get to Oregon for emergency surgery can't come in. I mean, all kinds of things were going on. People can't travel to their grandparents' funeral in Iran, right? I mean, things that are pretty important, right, were being impacted. And so I think that's why a lot of folks feel so strongly about it. One thing I want to say about the government's argument, because I have very strong views about it, this is from their brief. I think this is their brief before the Ninth Circuit. It may be for the trial court, but it's one of the briefs they filed. They argued that the temporary restraining order, of course, contravenes the considered judgment of Congress that the president should have the unreviewable authority to suspend the admission of any class of aliens. You'll note I put the words unreviewable authority in bold, right? Look, do I acknowledge that the president has broad discretion when it comes to issuing executive orders? You bet. You bet he does. Do I think that is unlimited? No, I do not. And so I was curious if they'd be asked about this position right before the Ninth Circuit, that the president's authority is unreviewable, right? And thankfully.
You're arguing then that the president's decision in that regard is unreviewable?
So it kind of went right to before I realized. So the judge on the Ninth Circuit asked, are you arguing then, to the Department of Justice, are you arguing then that the president's authority is unreviewable? It was a telephonic argument. And was that a 6-second pause? I need to time it someday. It was a long pause. And when you listen carefully to it, you can hear the shuffling of paper going on. And then he says, yes. Look, in my view, that has never been the law. It's not the law now, and it cannot be the law. I won't allow it to be the law, right? That is not okay. We are still a democracy. We have a system of checks and balances. It's why we have a judiciary. It's why I went to law school, for crying out loud, right? And so I find it, I mean, honestly, right, it angers me that our government is arguing before the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals that the president's authority to issue this executive order is unreviewable. I don't know how you feel about it, but I know how I feel about it, right? I know how the Ninth Circuit felt about it, right? 3-0 decision. When that attorney said yes, answer that question, if you want to know when I felt confident, really for the first time, that we're going to win, that was it. That was it. But that's really what's at stake in this case, right? Yes, it's an important case on a lot of levels, but when you kind of get right down to it, that is what they've argued. They've tried a bit now to back off from that a bit, but this was their argument for Judge Robart. And to Noah's credit, before Judge Robart, when they argued that, Noah went up and said that that argument was frightening. That was his; those were his words. We hadn't planned on them saying it was unreviewable. That was his initial, just his initial reaction, his response to it, which I was proud. He said it. So that's after the Ninth Circuit argument. So there's Noah looking a little tired. I'm smiling. I'm happy. I've got no problems, right? And there's Colleen. And so the Ninth Circuit argument, of course, was telephonic. So what we did, what Noah wanted, which I thought was the right thing, was he wanted to be in the room by himself for that telephonic argument. So we cleared out that whole wing of the floor. So like I went downstairs, we all went downstairs, just gave him that whole thing so he could just focus on his, so he could focus on his argument. But that's literally just 10 minutes after the argument. He was tired. He did not know, which was a good thing, that it was being live streamed like on CNN. And a German magazine came out to interview me for their like their Time magazine, and I was talking about the Ninth Circuit in a way that the argument is if they didn't really know too much about it. And she looked at me like I was crazy. She said all the media in Germany was live streaming that thing, the Ninth Circuit argument. I mean, it was all over the world. It's kind of crazy in a way. So that's right afterwards in Noah's office. So then the Ninth Circuit issued their opinion, a 3-0 decision. That's Noah and I immediately afterwards. We're just reading through it. Obviously, we read the first paragraph that says we won 3-0, so we're enjoying the we're enjoying it. And then right after, we went downstairs for a press conference after we won the Ninth Circuit. And so at that same time, the president issued a tweet. So, Dean, I had to have at least one tweet. I couldn't get through the whole thing without one tweet, right? So a reporter says to me, literally during the press conference, a reporter says, hey, the president just put out a tweet. I want you to comment on it. So that there's the tweet. See you in court. The security of our nation is at stake. All capital letters, by the way, exclamation point. To which I said, well, we've seen him in court, and we're 2-for-2, right? Somebody should let him know, right? This is, we're in court. And I also add that, look, I'm the father of young twins, as I've told you. I'm a believer in security, right? But I also believe the future of our Constitution is at stake, too, right? And the limits of presidential authority, that's at stake, too. These things are all at stake, right? Contrary to that tweet, they did not want to see us in court. They did not appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, which they obviously could have. They started slow-walking things to such a degree that Judge Robart, in one of the arguments or one of the hearings, questioned the Department of Justice saying, are you sure you want to slow-walk this? I think your client, the president, wants to move things along. That's almost a verbatim quote. I mean, it literally was. But they did not. The reason they did not want to appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, they were going to lose. By this time, we had more time with our arguments. We felt very, very confident at that point. We really did. We felt confident. And I don't mean win like it's going to be a 4-4 split and that upholds the Ninth Circuit. And a lot of people talk about it that way. We really felt our arguments were good. Our arguments were sound. We had good constitutional arguments. And this idea of unreviewable authority would not appeal to any member of the U.S. Supreme Court. So we felt confident. They wanted to withdraw their appeal. I made them pay the money that we had to for filing in the Ninth Circuit. We had to file some paperwork for a potential en banc appeal. So the federal government did write a check to the state of Washington for those costs, which I will not confirm or deny. I'm going to have that framed and put in my office, but it is, but it's possible. It's possible I'll do that. New executive order, 4 or 5 weeks go by, as you might recall, right? And during that time, we didn't know any day the executive order came out. I took a trip, by the way, during that week. Three college buddies and I just saw one of them this morning, actually. We're all turning 50 at the same time, basically. I'm giving away my age, right? I'm 52, but the others were all turning 50. So we had a long-planned trip to go to England to go watch English Premier League soccer games for 8 days. That's my idea of a vacation, right? So that's what we did. So I almost didn't take the trip because it's in the middle of all this, as you can imagine. But I said, we just got to do it. I'm planning it. And I hadn't really thought much about it, but when taking the trip, these three buddies I've known since I was a teenager, one of them, his name's Sam, he was born in Iran. And so I met him here on campus when we were teenagers. And he had a visa to be a student here. Then he later went to University of Washington Medical School, where I believe he finished first in his class at University of Washington Medical School. He's a doctor in town, he's married, has kids. And I won't share too much what Sam had to say, but we talked about it on that trip. How his life, or for his family, how different it would have been if there had been a travel ban, right? So these things are personal for a lot of us, I think. New executive order, there were big changes to it on the revised executive order. I won't go through all of them, but green card holders, taken out. Dual citizens, deleted. Visa holders, those 50 to 100,000 folks who had the travel visas, removed. That language about preferring the religious minorities in the country, that was removed as well. Iraq removed from being one of the affected countries. Syrian refugees treated like other countries. And the effective date was 10 days away as opposed to immediately. So they made a lot of changes to it. So we had a hard decision. We still think it's unconstitutional, right? So we spent some time thinking about it, I think about a day and a half to look at it. And in the end, we decided to file a lawsuit against the revised travel ban. And in essence, it was, unquestionably a narrower group of individuals adversely impacted by the revised travel ban. There's no doubt about that. And that's a good thing, obviously, right? We feel good we won on the first case, and that is over. But if you just look at the language, compare the two travel bans, the two executive orders, and if you compare, for example, language of the ban on for the U.S. The refugee program or the Six Nation ban, if you look at the language, they're essentially the same. Language really hasn't changed. The scale has narrowed, but it hasn't changed otherwise, so we still felt it's still unconstitutional. Next steps, there was a challenge. We challenged, AG in Hawaii challenged, in Maryland, the ACLU and some private individuals challenged. Also here in Seattle, the Northwest Immigrant Rights Project challenged. There's an article in today's Seattle Times about Jorge Barone. He's the executive director of the Northwest Immigrant Rights Project. Incredible guy. You really should read that article about Jorge Barone if you want to be inspired about what people are doing. He's an incredible guy, incredible lawyer. So multiple lawsuits for the revised travel ban in three different courts, all on the same day, the afternoon before it goes into effect. While we were in court before Judge Robart, the Hawaii judge ruled in favor of granting an injunction. The Maryland judge ruled quickly thereafter in the same way. So Judge Robart decided he did not have to make a ruling, which does not surprise us at that point. So we are still proceeding on the merits, right? Because it's an injunction, so we still have to go forward on the merits. So we're asking for discovery and to take depositions and to get documents while the appeals go up in the Ninth Circuit and the Fourth Circuit. And I think on the Fourth Circuit, I think I just got word that it's going to go en banc. That originally would be a three-judge panel, but I think it's the same date, May 8th, for going en banc to the Fourth Circuit. Last slide, and I'll take your questions, is I mentioned earlier we've had just a lot of response, and those are just some of the letters that people have sent. I mean, there's thousands of them. And the common denominator, the dean and I were talking about this a little bit earlier, the common denominator in the letters is, they're highly personalized letters that people are writing, as you can imagine, right? And so many people write from personal experience that, you know, includes little kids, right, whose families are impacted, or their best friend, you know, is impacted, or their family. A lot of people just write to say, hey, that the lawsuit and the outcome affirms their feelings about our system of government, checks and balances. It's like nothing I've ever experienced. I mean, you know, I've been practicing law a long time, and it's, you could take the 20 next most important cases I've had and combine those in terms of reaction or feelings that people have about it, pro or con, believe me, I hear both sides, and it still wouldn't equal just this one case, you know, and people have super strong views about it on both sides. Believe me, I hear from, you know, from people on both sides of it, but the team's done a really great job. And so just a thought to leave you with is, you know, I'm a big believer in public service with the law. You guys all have a gift, right? The students, you're going to be graduates of one of the best law schools in the country, right? You have a lot of options ahead of you, right? You all do, right? And you must be talented or you would not have gotten into this law school, right? I survived career-wise despite not getting into University of Washington, right? But you guys have all gotten in. And you got a lot of options. And you know, I spent 4 or 5 wonderful years in my law firm, right? They were great years. I learned a ton from the lawyers there. But I knew when I walked out the door, they were going to fill my spot the next day with a lawyer every bit as good as me. Like my clients, the businesses I represented, right, they were not going to go wanting for lack of excellent, excellent legal services. I knew that, right? I'm telling you, that's not the case for a lot of people in our state, We just don't have legal reputation at all. They need a lawyer, any lawyer, but particularly a good lawyer, right? And so the need is tremendous. And look, you don't get paid as much, at my particular law firm, for example, or Jorge Barone, who I hope you all read about in the Seattle Times. He's a Yale law grad. He could be in a corner office in any law firm in the country if he wanted to, right? But he's working on behalf of the Northwest Immigrant Rights Project. but he's making a profound difference in people's lives. So I just really encourage you to think about it. If you're interested in the AG's office, Amber is here, and Amber is right over here. Amber, maybe just stand up. So Amber's an attorney in our office, so she's here and available afterwards. I have to have a little plug for the AG's office, Dean, right? So Amber's available if you have any questions about recruitment or what we do and all that stuff. Feel free to talk to Amber or to me. And with that, I'm happy to take any questions that any of you have. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much. It's so good to hear this background and share the story with you personally like this. With that, go ahead.
General Ferguson, you mentioned how important it was to have your team and all of the talent and wisdom of your team. Right not long after the election, in this very room, we had a panel of some of our professors talking about the transition and the coming Trump administration and what it might look like on a daily basis not being able to attract good talent to run departments and agencies. I can't imagine anything more than the law where that really matters. From what you've seen, what can you comment on presumably the Trump administration's inability to probably attract good legal talent in a case like this or any other cases?
Yeah, I guess I'm not sure if I really can speak to that. I mean, I guess I'll say this. As the Department of Justice, just like in our office, right, there are career attorneys and professional staff who have dedicated themselves, right, to the rule of law, right? Now, look, I have no doubt, because I've had conversations with some of those attorneys who I know, who some of those folks are kind of wondering, hey, do they want to stay or do they need to make a change, right? But look, I mean, Department of Justice, they had a hard argument to make, right? I was a little hard on them here, but they had a tough argument to make, in my view, and they had a difficult client, right? And I'm not sure how much they were in the loop on the front end for getting that executive order crafted. My suspicion is very, very little, if at all. So, look, I think the Department of Justice, for example, is always going to attract strong lawyers, but it's the direction of the office, right, is where I have some concern, right? The leader of any entity like that, you know, different folks have different priorities, and, you know, I'm not sure I can sort of comment a whole lot more beyond that, but I think the Department of Justice, the good folks are working there, and they're going to continue working there. I feel confident about that. The leadership of the office, look, I'm going to have some disagreements with. Go right ahead. Don't be shy. Step right on up.
Can I just start by saying you guys are so cool.
Thank you. I'll tell the team.
But anyway, I noticed reading about the case coming out of Hawaii and a little bit in the earlier case, there was some argument from the defendants about not looking beyond the four corners of the executive order itself. Is that level of deference going to be solidified once we get past the motion to dismiss or the TRO stage? I mean, I'm worried about that, especially with the language of giving preferential treatment to religious minorities. Now that on its face, once you take out the campaign rhetoric, it might not actually look like it violates the Establishment Clause or other federal laws.
Really good question. A question we've spent a lot of time thinking about, as you might imagine. And it's also been a big conversation in the public, right? A lot of people, when I do these TV interviews, a lot of people say, well, hey, if you read the executive order, you don't see the words Muslim, this is a Muslim ban anywhere, right? It's not on there. But as this group knows better than most, you can look beyond the four corners of any document to determine whether it's unconstitutional, right? Our test for that aspect of our claim, the First Amendment, the Muslim ban, is we have to show that a motivating factor, not the motivating factor, but a motivating factor behind the adoption of the executive order was religious animus towards Muslims, right? And so in order to do that, this happens in courtrooms all around the country all the time, right, is you look to statements from the principals, for example. Perfectly normal. You take their depositions, you ask them, what were you thinking? Why did you adopt that? Show us your emails. What was the thinking behind the adoption of that law, or in this case, that executive order? Now, I have folks say to me, this is unprecedented, right? Taking a president's statement during a campaign, using it against him in a court of law. My response is, I'll tell you what's unprecedented, is a president saying, or a candidate saying he's going to adopt a Muslim ban, right? That's what's unprecedented, and there's nothing unprecedented in the courts to say, hey, what the principals are saying, publicly or not, that's relevant to a determination of whether that document is lawful or not as well. So frankly, we look forward to getting, we've always felt we had a strong case up front based on those statements. We haven't taken discovery yet. We haven't gotten emails yet, taken depositions. My team has drawn straws on who gets to take Rudy Giuliani's deposition, right? So
I'd volunteer for that.
Right, exactly. They're all volunteering. So, but in all seriousness, right, that is, what were they looking at, if anything, right, making that decision? So I understand that to the public, it can seem strange. Hey, it's a campaign. Aren't you kind of freewheeling it a little bit? But we think, no, he wasn't freewheeling, as evidenced by the executive order itself, and reinforced by statements like Rudy Giuliani, which make it very clear. I talked to him. He said, put together a commission, create a Muslim ban, just make it legal. We think that's a challenge to make that legal. Yeah. Thanks for that question. That's an important one.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi. Thank you for coming, and thanks for the work that you do.
Thanks.
So please correct me if my reasoning is wrong here. Sure. I'm like a 1-0, so
sure.
It's often wrong. So the argument that a ban targeting 6 countries which happen to be Muslim majority thereby amounts to a ban against Muslims mm-hmm. bears a striking resemblance to me to the argument advanced by some so-called jihadists that basically the way in which we war against Muslim-majority countries, the unilateral exertion of military force against Muslim-majority countries thereby amounts to war on Islam, in their view. The argument seems similar to me in terms of the argument that you're making and the argument that they're making. First of all, is that correct, that kind of resemblance? Am I right to see that? If I am, what do you think about that argument? And would you ever make the case that the war on terror, as we are doing it, is potentially a war on Islam?
Yeah, I guess I'm not sure how to answer that. I mean, I haven't thought in that way. But what I can say is that look, a lot of folks have focused on saying, hey, Bob, this is about national security, right? This executive order is about national security. And so why are you questioning that? The president has access to information, right, on what countries pose the greatest danger to us. It's not your purview, right, to question that, nor should it really be the court's purview, I guess, by extension. And that hasn't been the law either in our country, right? In other words, that if you were to look at what was put before Judge Robart, there was actually more evidence in the record that the actions by the president executive order hurt national security than helped. One of our declarations was from a group of national security experts. It wasn't a bunch of liberals. There was like the CIA director of George W. Bush signed a declaration saying this was bad for national security, right? Okay? And the administration put nothing forward on that, right? And they're entitled to do that, and they can have it reviewed by the court where it's not made public. They simply did not do that. And so, look, I can't speak to sort of other elements to inform policy. What I can say is that if the administration has an argument that this is done for national security reasons, that's an argument they need to make before the court, right? And in our view, that simply hasn't been done at this point.
Well, let's take this opportunity to say thank you once again, Attorney General Ferguson.
Thanks for streaming this episode of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle, featuring a talk by Washington State Attorney General Bob Ferguson. He spoke at the University of Washington's William H. Gates Hall on March 11th. Tune in again soon.